This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to the Woman's Hour podcast for Wednesday, the 5th of August. Good morning. This morning, the funeral of John Hume, the Northern Irish politician and a Nobel Prize winner, will be held in Londonderry. He's survived by his wife and professional partner, Pat. Who is the woman for whom the John and Pat Hume Foundation for Peaceful Change and Reconciliation was formed? As female artists outnumber men on the shortlist for the Mercury Prize for the first time, Georgia, who's been nominated for her album Seeking Thrills, and a novel which spans more than 20 years and is set in London and Kenya, Homecoming, is by Luann Goldie. As you may have seen in today's papers, the Duchess of Cambridge spent yesterday unloading boxes of baby clothes in Sheffield for a Baby Banks charity, in which retailers donate items of clothing, nappies, formula and equipment across the UK. New figures from the three big charities, Baby Basics, Little Village and Abba Necessities, have published figures this week which show the number of families with children under five who've needed their help has risen significantly since the coronavirus crisis began. Well, how are they managing to cope? Lauren Elric has a 15-month-old daughter and uses Abba Necessities in Aberdeenshire. Sophia Parker is chief executive of Little Village Baby Bank in London, and Tracy Thorne is an NHS family nurse also in Aberdeen. Tracy, why have so many more people needed to be referred to a baby bank?
Hello, I think there's many varied reasons as to why families are needing baby banks more than ever during the pandemic. There's every family's story is completely different, but it's a combination of families such as Lauren's where additional hours that were relied upon are no longer available. There's families where they were on a temporary contract that suddenly ended. There is possibly a delay in accessing universal credit. So I've got a family just now who were self-employed, had been self-employed for less than a year. So unfortunately for them, they had to access universal credit. And to actually get that funds in place, there was a delay, which meant they had no money for a period of weeks. So I think there's lots of different reasons. Every family story is unique, but no family that I have on my caseload has not been affected by COVID-19. On a financial basis.
Lauren, how would you describe the impact the lockdown has had on you?
The impact, it's made me feel very isolated. Also with my partner not getting as much hours at his work, we have struggled to afford essential items for our daughter, like nappies. And that's where Abba Necessities stepped in and really helped us.
How much are you in the country, and so it's not easy to find places, even if you could afford it, to buy things?
Yeah, we don't have any big supermarkets in the small village that we stay in. There is a little corner shop, and even their prices are quite a bit more expensive than what they would be in the supermarkets. So we only have a limited amount of items in the shop as well to be able to buy. And even the shop here, we're struggling to keep its stock up. You know, even simple things, nappies and that, was very, very difficult to get hold of.
Savaya, how difficult have you found having enough things to fulfil the need in your area?
Hi, good morning. So at Little Village, we support families across the whole of London. And much of what Lauren was saying is really echoed by the families that we've been meeting as well. I think it had, at the beginning of the lockdown, it was very, very difficult for people to find those basic essentials, things like nappies, and where they were unable to go to the supermarkets, they were then going to local corner shops where those items were much more expensive. In our experience, I mean, we've been incredibly lucky to have amazing support from our local communities, people donating and buying nappies for us via our wholesaler. But there's no question that the level of demand that we're now facing, the number of requests for support, is making it very challenging to continue to meet those requests.
Now, the Duchess Sophia has persuaded, I think it's 19 retailers, to donate 10,000 new items to more than 40 baby banks around the country. How important will those donations be?
That's right. We feel so lucky at Little Village to be part of this campaign, along with Baby Basics and ABBA Necessities. And it's just brilliant to see the Duchess of Cambridge using her position in this way to bring all those lovely British brands on board to support our baby banks across the UK. And there's no question in my mind that the things that those brands are going to be providing to families via us will be a huge lifeline. They will help financially, but also to reduce the anxiety and the stress that the parents we're supporting are experiencing. But I think we need to be really clear that while they are a lifeline, what they aren't going to do is reduce the soaring inequality we're seeing in this country. And I think we also need to be looking at that issue as well.
But what range of goods are coming to you as a result of this push?
Oh, I mean, it's wonderful. Some really, really beautiful, beautiful things. So lots of toiletries for babies and for mums, play equipment, weaning equipment, all the essentials, which I think what's going to be really lovely in being able to give them out is that they really will feel like a gift from one family to another, which is very much what we stand for at Little Village. And I know it's something that ABBA Necessities and Baby Basics, and indeed all the other baby banks we work with, think is very important, that the items we give out are great quality. They don't feel like a handout at all.
Lauren, how did ABBA Necessities help you? How did it work practically?
They were absolutely brilliant. What had happened was I spoke to Tracy, my family nurse, and then she referred me to ABBA Necessities. I received items like clothes, nappies, formula milk. Not just that, but also for my daughter's birthday, I received gifts for her that I wasn't able to afford. Christmas as well, we got some gifts then for my daughter, but also things for myself, toiletries and just things to make me feel quite nice as well. So there was quite a big range of things that I was given.
But Tracy, what's it like for you trying to find people who might need your help and need to be referred to a baby bank when you can't really meet them face to face?
No, unfortunately, that's correct. We can't meet most of our families face to face. We are still having some face to face interactions with families, such as families that have got child protection or there's concerns about mental health or newborn babies. But the way my role works, we've built quite a therapeutic relationship with my families. I've got a caseload of 25 and we have a very good working relationship with each other. So we're keeping in contact with our families through video conference calls. So we're still keeping connected and having those conversations. So for the role that I'm doing, it's not been too affected. I'm still being able to have that connection, and families have been able to report to me, you know, that they are struggling.
But how often are people having problems with technology? I mean, if you're living in a very rural community and you haven't got much money, you exactly. might not have the computer, the Wi-Fi, all of those things that, that most people are taking for granted.
Absolutely, and that's been an enormous challenge, especially with a lot of young families. That's been very difficult, and we have come across those problems, unfortunately. When that does occur, sometimes we're doing just like garden doorstep visits, so we can just connect with family, have those conversations, but at a social distance. We just go back down to basics and we have those telephone conversations. So although we can't actually see the family, we're still keeping connected by at least a phone call.
How are you managing in that area, Sophia, in London? How has it affected the way you can help families and get in contact with them?
Yeah, I mean, so we had a very intense period at the beginning of lockdown back in March, where we had to basically completely redesign our operations. Normally, families are welcomed into our hubs and able to choose the items that they want and need for their children. We now operate a delivery service where we get that stuff out to the families that need it safely and securely directly to their doorsteps. And we have an amazing team of volunteers who are between them calling around about 200 families a week. Like Tracy was saying, we've gone back to the good old fashioned phone and are just checking in with families. And certainly what we are seeing is that, as well as the kind of financial stresses that lockdown brought, I think we're seeing families that were already quite isolated and anxious. We're seeing that many of the places they went to for support, be that, you know, the playgroups, the other local charity drop-in sessions, Little Village, those things have had to close down, and so that's leaving them even more isolated. And when you're in a damp and cramped room, often without much outside space, that can be a very challenging place to be.
Lauren, obviously the things that you've had to help you have been wonderful. But how important has Tracy's personal support been to you?
Tracy has helped me so much, also emotionally. It's so nice to feel like I have someone there to help me through anything, any questions I have, or, you know, someone just to speak to. She's not a judgmental person at all. She's so kind and friendly, and I really, really do appreciate everything that Tracy does for me.
Sophia, this is not coming to an end quickly, this difficult period. How do you reckon you'll get through the next few months?
Well, we've always said at Little Village that our currency is kindness. I think we'll be getting through with the support of our local communities, with the support of the brands like the Duchess has brought together, with the incredible dedication of our volunteers. But I'm very clear that this is not going to be easy. When we first started looking at the impact of COVID, we were thinking it was going to be a kind of sharp spike for 3 months and then it might normalise. But actually, we're now planning for a sustained increase in demand. We're on track to meet 6,000 kids this year and support them. It was 3,000 in 2019, and I know many other baby banks are in a similar situation. So it's a case of continuing to fundraise, continuing to keep that support coming in, asking people to continue donating essential items to us so we can get them out to the families that need them most, and we'll just keep going.
And just briefly, Sophia, if there's someone listening who feels that she or he might need some help, how do they get the referral?
So they can go, most baby banks operate a referral system, so you would need to be referred by a professional, but that's not a complicated process. So you can go to a health visitor, a teacher, a counsellor, anyone in a professional role, and ask them to refer you to your nearest baby bank. We have a map on our website of all the baby banks across the UK, so you can find your nearest one on that map on our website.
Sophia Parker, Lauren Elric and Tracy Thorne, thank you all very much indeed for being with us. Now, for the first time in its 29-year history, female musicians, singers and bands fronted by women have outnumbered men on the shortlist for the Mercury Prize, alongside Dua Lipa and Laura Marling, Georgia has been nominated for her second album, Seeking Thrills. Here's just a selection of tracks. I don't have Georgia, congratulations on your nomination. Now, this has come 25 years after your father was nominated. He was one half of the duo Left Field. What does it mean to you to be nominated?
Hi, Jenny. Thank you for having me on the show. It's incredibly special. I remember when my mum and dad went to the awards ceremony. Bit more rock and roll back in those days, I think. I remember my dad coming back with this award. They didn't win it. I think they lost to Portishead. But I remember them bringing back this award, and it was a very odd-looking thing. And I remember being quite sort of intrigued by it. And it's kind of lived with us through my whole career, really. And so it means a great deal, I think.
Now, the album is described thus, a daring story of hedonism, self-discovery, and the transcendental power of the dance floor. How would you describe it?
I think that's very accurate. I wrote this album when I was kind of embarking on this sober point in my life. I've cut drinking and I cut all kind of sort of hedonistic behaviour out a little bit. And I did really find myself in situations on the dance floor where I felt kind of transcendental moments, and I saw humanity at its best, really, on the dance floor. And I felt really inspired by that. And I just locked myself away in the studio and wrote these collections of songs. I think that's a very accurate description, really.
So what did you really discover about yourself on the dance floor?
I think I just had these moments of just like, I like being observant of people. I like seeing people come together. I love music. I think before, going to dance floors were just like, you know, it was just like being with your mates, getting drunk and rah, 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 and I think this time I just truly appreciated the DJs and the music and how music can really just bring people together and also kind of make you forget for a time about the struggles in your life. And perhaps in those split moments, you can kind of discover things that are new about yourself. And I think it's just the power of music, really. I'm a bit of a music nerd, Jenny, really. I remember we were at this one rave in Manchester, and my friends hearing this will love this, but there was a moment where there's this pinnacle moment that it reaches on the dance floor where it's about 2 o'clock, and then the DJs will just drop a disco record, and they drop Vera, Take Me to the Bridge, and the whole atmosphere of the room just turned into this incredible, like, it was almost like a beating heart. And me and my friends just turned together, and there's love, you know, there was love in the room. And I think they were just really precious moments, timeless moments I'll remember forever.
And I know you wrote and produced everything. You play the drums and you sing. How easy is it to combine all that?
I've never really thought about it. I've always just done it, you know. I learned the drums when I was very young. It was just something I could do. I just sat behind the kit and I loved it. And I think through the way I learned the drums was I sang the rhythms and I sang the melodies of the songs I was learning. So I think by developing like that, I could just, you know, in the end, sing and play the drums. So that's how I do my live show, actually. But, you know, I just love instruments. I love the process of creating. I'm very much a studio person as well, as much as a performer. I love being in the studio. I love equipment and I love, you know, just creating sounds. I've got a big keyboards collection now. And I just, again, I'm a bit of a nerd, really, I guess.
But that presumably that comes from growing up in a very musical family.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when I was born, my mum and dad were living in a cooperative flat in near Baker Street, and they had to sort of kind of adapt to having this newborn baby. And my bedroom ended up being Left Field studio where they wrote the first record. So I think I was just kind of surrounded by weird equipment from a very early age. And I guess my kind of, just being intrigued by them would develop from there. But my mum, she loves music. Music is a soundtrack to her life. I mean, she introduced me to artists like Joni Mitchell and kind of soul music and Neil Young, you know. So I have grown up in a very musical household. But then my dad would play like techno records and I'd hear like African music. And yeah, so it has been a mixture of an upbringing.
You see, that's interesting because I know you went to the Brit School, but you also studied ethnomusicology at the School of Oriental and African Studies. How does that influence the music that you're making now?
Well, I think the whole kind of academic process really kind of helps me. I really did research this new record, Seeking Thrills. I almost like I was researching a paper, really. I delved into the history of dance music. I went right back to the kind of 80s of where it all began in the late 70s. And I sort of implanted a bit of my knowledge of how culture affects music, how music affects culture. And that's what I learned in ethnomusicology. My particular area was West Africa. And then also I just loved Southeast Asian music, like Balinese and Javanese gamelan was kind of like my thing. But I guess, you know, you analyze how music and culture kind of play intertwine with each other. And I guess that kind of thought process has just lived with me throughout creating my music. And I've always tried to be authentic and respectful. I've never wanted to just, you know, take. And I think, yeah, that definitely comes from a respect you learn from those sorts of studies, really. And knowing that, you know, it doesn't just end with pop music. You know, music all around the world is as important, really. So I guess it just kind of opened my eyes to different things.
And briefly, how are you coping with lockdown with your music?
Well, you know, it was pretty heavy, really, because I put Seeking Thrills out in January, hoping to kind of promote it for a year and a half. And then all the shows got pulled and obviously cancelled or postponed, but we still don't really know what's going to happen. So for about a month, I was really quite low and just like, oh no, this is terrible. But then I'm quite lucky in the fact that I have a home studio. And so I just, in the end, do what I do best and just bury myself in music. And I'm now writing new songs and collaborating, and it feels better. But, you know, I can't complain. When I put things into perspective, I have had, you know, the opportunity to create and keep my artistry going. So.
And now you've got a nomination for the Mercury Prize. So the very best of luck with that. Georgia, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Jenny. Thank you.
Now, still to come in today's programme, Homecoming, a novel by Luann Goldie set in London and Kenya during a period of more than 20 years. What damage can a secret love affair do? And the serial, the third episode of Bloody Ice Stepford. Now, earlier in the week, you may have missed the teenage girls who set up Kids Against Plastic and the first in a series about how we live with scars. If you miss the live programme, it's not difficult to find us. You can download the BBC Sounds app and all you have to do is search for Woman's Hour, and there we are. Now, it's often assumed that the widow of a famous man will, in her grief, stay out of the limelight, as she has probably done throughout their lives together. That is not the case for Pat Hume, whose husband John died earlier this week. His funeral will be held today. John Hume won the Nobel Prize for his role in the Northern Ireland peace process, but his wife had been at his side and an active partner through the tough times, during the troubles, during peace, and his years of suffering with dementia. So who is Pat Hume? Well, I'm joined by Monica McWilliams, Emeritus Professor at Ulster University, and Emma O'Callaghan, a former BBC News editor in Derry. Emma, you watched them as a reporter for a long time. How did they work together?
Good morning, Jenny. They worked as a perfect partnership. They complemented each other. Pat was never the quiet wife in the background doing her duty. She was John's equal intellectually, politically, and every other way. She's been described as his eyes and ears on the ground when he would have been away travelling internationally, doing what he was doing best. And she was there in touch with the ordinary people, looking after the ordinary issues and keeping a feel for the place. And she was his advisor, confidant, protector, supporter, everything that a partner could be.
Monica, we know they had five children and had a very, very tough time, particularly during the 70s and 80s. What kind of toll did that really difficult period have on them?
Well, Pat was a survivor, as most of us had to become, and she was a teacher. And she had to become the breadwinner because the assembly collapsed in 1974, putting John, who had been a minister and a leader in those negotiations, out of a job. So she just got on with her life, rearing five children, bringing in the money, making sure they stayed safe, and supporting him in every possible way. And when he got back into politics, she was running the constituency work for him, entertaining politicians in her home, making pots of stew, putting on the kettle, speaking to journalists, doing everything a politician does. But in those early days, they were tough. I remember Pat describing John coming home after one of the first civil rights marches, the 5th of October, I think in 68, soaked to the skin. He had been standing trying to pacify things and knew they were getting out of hand, but it didn't help when he got covered from head to toe by a water cannon, as did most people who were there. So that's the kind of life, and she had to protect her children and aid in her son.
Because the family home was
attacked.
A dangerous place, wasn't it?
Yes, and John was taking risks personally for political reasons, but it was her and the family at times alone when John was travelling, as cards often do, came to harass them. And Pat walked, as Aidan told me, across the border with five children into Donegal to get some respite from it all and to keep them safe. So she knew about what security and safety meant, and so did John in trying to create a more peaceful society.
Now, I think to a lot of people, a turning point in the peace process was when John began talking to the Sinn Féin president, Gerry Adams. I think that was in 1993. Let's just listen to Pat remembering that time.
A neighbour had seen Gerry Adams and knew that he had been with John. And the following day, it spread like wildfire that John Hume was speaking to Gerry Adams. And immediate demonisation began. He was vilified from one end of Ireland to the other end of Ireland for what he was doing.
How did that feel at the time, being in the eye of that storm?
It was very, very, very difficult, and very difficult for our children as well, to read in the papers. They just were... I hadn't told any of them about John and these talks, and they were completely at sea about the whole thing and found it difficult.
There were party members and friends and colleagues who were also at a loss to understand why John was engaged in those talks.
Yes. John had kept the talks very much to himself because I think his feeling was if heads were to roll, let his head roll.
Ema, how involved was she with the peace process as it went on, and politicians like Bill Clinton who came along?
She was always there as a presence. I think, you know, what's significant about that interview that we just listened to, Pat was saying she didn't tell her children. Nobody in the community at large knew what was going on between John Hume and Gerry Adams, but Pat was part of it. Pat was privy to that information, so she was sharing that burden with him. So she was very much part, the other half of John. She mingled with presidents and prime ministers and diplomats. She would have entertained people from the highest order at home in Derry or at her home in Donegal. But she was always totally at ease, totally confident, self-assured, never overawed by the occasions or by personalities. You know, she was a woman without pretension, and was happiest when she was among her own people, probably. But she could acquit herself in any company. A brave, feisty, intelligent, clever woman, you know, and a confidant, obviously, of John's.
You know, I think it's really important that the foundation was the John and Pat Hume Foundation for Peaceful Change and Reconciliation, that both their names are there. And she also had a Lifetime Achievement Award in 2018. What did all that mean to her?
I think at the time it was embarrassing for her. Pat, while she was always there by John's side, she didn't seek the limelight. She didn't want to be out front. So in November 2018, the Irish Red Cross announced they were going to honour her with a Lifetime Award for service to the community, basically. And it was the first time, I think, that I was ever conscious of Pat being up there on the stage. She went to a gala dinner in Dublin, and she was dressed for the occasion. She was in the limelight. The award was presented by the former SDLP leader, Mark Durkan. And John wasn't able to go. He was too ill at that stage. And, you know, Mark Durkan paid great tributes to her, said she was lauded as a sense of heart and hope and a perpetual tonic during the Troubles, a true humanitarian ethic, you know, that's what she had. But Pat's reaction was that, first of all, she was shocked by the response. She was overwhelmed. She was humbled. And then in her acceptance of the award, what she said is that, "I have gradually come to recognise that I am here to represent many people, people who have struggled to sustain fundamental human values amidst the brutal tragedy of social conflict, and also of those who struggle with the smaller daily challenges of living alongside long-term illness." You know, she was an incredibly modest woman.
How significant, Monica, was her openness about her husband's dementia?
She spoke publicly when the book was published in 2015 on the Irish RTE channel. And it's very, very sad to listen to that, but also very powerful. It reflected Pat in every way I knew her. Warm, kind, honest, but realistic. And she talked about living with dementia and how people didn't understand dementia. And I used to sit beside John after he was ill, and I understood what she must have been going through, and it was a long, long illness. What people forget is the toll that often public life can take on people, like politicians like John, who took risks, and Pat herself was obviously paying the price of that too at times, because I remembered when he had to get emergency surgery, as we were both travelling together at the time. I was going to the States, he was going to Switzerland, and he ended up with a serious operation in Zurich. So Pat was accustomed to having emergencies and dealing with crises, and she was calm, always calm. That's how I remember her, unflustered. When I said about the cup of tea, it's very powerful what can happen, as we've just heard from Emer, underneath the radar, when you sit and enter a dialogue, a very important dialogue. Someone described it as the Cobra Room in Derry, when those talks were taking place, and they were making such a difference. And it was her who was creating the calmness, pouring the oil in troubled waters, as Breech Rogers described her. That's the woman I knew. And she was also a public speaker. She probably didn't seek the limelight in any way, but some of the best speeches I ever heard came from Pat. She didn't make them often, but she stood up in Washington when she was appointed after the Good Friday Agreement, along with Daphne Trimble, who was married to Dave Trimble. And they were appointed to monitor and see if they could fundraise for victims just after we had signed the agreement in 1998. And it was a very powerful speech. And it would have, anybody would have reached into their pockets after hearing Pat speak.
Well, Monica McWilliams and Emma O'Callaghan, thank you both very much indeed for being with us today and telling us about John Hume's wife, Pat. Well, now his widow, of course. Thank you both very much indeed. Now, in Luan Goldie's novel Homecoming, a young man, Kiama, wants to go back to Kenya at the age of 18, 10 years after the death of his mother there. He wants his mother's best friend Yvonne to come with him so that he can visit his grandparents and his old nanny. The novel takes place in both London and Kenya and is set in the early 2000s, 2010 and 2020. Underneath the narrative is a secret. Kiama's father Lewis had not been faithful to his mother Emma and in fact had long been in love with Yvonne as she was with him. It's complicated. Luan, what drew you to write about London and Kenya?
Morning. Well, I'm from London and my last novel was purely set in East London. So I knew I wanted to set a novel in London again. I could see Kiama and I could see the characters Emma and her friend Yvonne. They were in London. That's where they started. That's where they met each other at university in Harrow. But I knew there had to be this huge trip to Kenya, and it was just a case of matching the two stories up.
What about your interest in what are clearly the complications of a friendship between two women? Where did that come from?
Just life, really. I mean, the female friendship, it's quite romanticized when you think about it, that you know, the idea you have this best friend and you share everything and it's this perfect relationship. And, you know, I have really close female friends that I've had in my life for 10, 20 years, but we do have those moments sometimes where we hate each other and we drive each other mad. So I wanted to have a realistic friendship between two women, and your friendships, they change as you change. You know, one of you has a baby, one of you doesn't, one of you's really successful in your career, the other one isn't. All these things have a huge impact on a relationship, especially between two women who are as close as the two women are in this story.
And what about your interest in the dangers of a long-held secret?
Ooh, well, it's very interesting when you think about all the secrets that are lurking within families and friendships, and some of them, you know, they might start off quite small. I think with the women in the story, one of them kept a secret from her friend and she didn't even think of it as a secret. It was just something small. I don't need to tell Emma what happened. But over the years, it got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it has this huge impact and it changes all these different people's lives. So it's amazing when you think about it, what a secret can do if it's kept a secret for too long.
Now, the London setting in the earlier novel you mentioned, Nightingale Point, is a council estate tower block. How important is it to you to write about the London that's really familiar only to people who live there? It's not tourist London.
No, I guess not. But when I started writing Nightingale Point, I didn't really think about that. It was just that's where the book was set. Those were the people. It was only after, when the book was published and people kept saying, why did you choose this setting? You know, it's really unusual, a council estate, but is it? I mean, they're everywhere and so many people live on them. So many people come from them. I didn't really think it was that unusual, but maybe it's just unusual in the setting of a book.
How did you research it?
Well, Nightingale Point is about, it's based on a disaster that happened in Holland in the mid 90s. So I researched that event, but this is a piece of fiction. Nightingale Point is obviously not a real place in East London. So a lot of it was fiction, but it was based on this real event that happened.
Now, back to Kiama, the poor lad. he's raised by his father after his mother's death and his nana Julie. Now, the way you portray her home, it's bustling, the characters speak to each other very truthfully, the dialogue is real, you know, you're very good at that. How did you get it right, that dialogue?
Oh, thank you. I don't know, with the dialogue, that's always what comes first for me when I'm writing. I can hear the characters talking. I feel like I just hear their conversations. So I always start off with the dialogue. It flows really easy. It's all the other stuff that's a bit more difficult for me as a writer. But I could hear the conversations between Kiyama and his father. I could hear the noise from all the cousins in the garden and this busy sort of household. The same way I could hear the conversations between Kiyama and his mum when he's younger, when it's just the two of them in this house. This is before he loses his mum. I don't know, I can just hear it. I've just got an ear for the way people speak.
Now, in 2017, you won the Costa Short Story Award for Two Steak Bakes and Two Chelsea Buns. What was the impact on your reputation as a writer of winning that?
Well, it was fantastic. I hadn't been published before. I'd been a sort of runner-up in a few smaller competitions, and then when I was shortlisted for the Costa, it's just amazing because it's such a big prize for an unpublished writer, and you get to go to this fabulous party, and you know, you get a lovely amount of money even if you come in third place. So I was just really happy, and then when I won it, it was quite a shock. The competition was really tight. And then it sort of got the attention to my novel. I had a novel that was finished. I had an agent. The novel was sort of floating around, but it hadn't been picked up. So winning the Costa Short Story Prize, it did so much for me. It was amazing.
Now, I know when you're not writing, you work as a primary school teacher, which yes, maybe takes up an awful lot of your time, most of the time. How does that influence the writing?
You know, I'm not sure if it does influence my writing. I'm primary, so I teach mostly year one and year two, so the youngest children in the school. Yeah, it's more just sort of balancing it out. I'm 3 days a week at school at the moment, in normal times I am. So, yeah, it's just a case of balancing it all up. The two things don't really complement each other, I guess. It's a bit of a balancing act.
Are you looking forward to going back properly in September?
I'm so, yeah, really, really looking forward. We're all looking forward to going back, but obviously there is a little bit of anxiety about it. But I think most teachers would say the same. We just want to get back in the classroom. We just want all our children back. We want it to be safe. It's been very difficult teaching children from home. It's, you know, our children are so young, the kids I teach. So it's been difficult. Yeah, we're looking forward to September and learning how to work in a new way.
I was talking to Luann Goldie. Mick sent us a tweet. Great to listen to Woman's Hour talking about Pat Hume. When I was young, she was the one my parents went to get things sorted out while John was doing the big stuff. None of it would have happened without Pat. Some of you got in touch about baby banks. Fiona emailed, "Whilst I appreciate all the work going into supporting people in need, the bigger question we should be asking is why one of the richest economies in the world is in this situation. Should this not be part of the feature, or are we going to normalise baby banks in the way food banks have been, thereby absolving the government of any responsibility?" Hilary said, "I think the support organisations for new mothers and babies is fantastic. However, I don't understand why the use of reusable nappies is not promoted, as this would take away the insecurity of not having enough nappies, as well as being better for the environment. New style reusable nappies are shaped, easy to use and wash, and need no further expense in the long run, much cheaper than continually buying new nappies, except maybe for liners and a few pairs of panties to contain them." Now, do join me tomorrow when we'll have the next in our series about living with scars. Emily explains why her self-harm scars represent both pain and overcoming it. And I'll be talking to Zadie Smith about her new book of essays, which she wrote in the early months of lockdown. That's tomorrow morning, usual time, 10:02. Until then, bye-bye.
From the one village behind the mountain.
Imagine you're living a very different life on the other side of the world.
You feel I cannot do anything.
You live silently in the shadows.
Just stay home, bring children, make food.
And then someone takes your child, disappears into the night with your little girl, and you can't stay silent any longer. And you'll do whatever it takes. Travel thousands of miles across the globe to find your missing daughter.
this is my child. I look after this child like tiger. Just go everywhere.
Join me, Sue Mitchell, for this gripping new BBC Radio 4 podcast series. Subscribe to Girl Taken on BBC Sounds.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.